Hello and welcome. I'm Jennifer March, and this is not your mother's story time. This week, we bring you Queer and The Untold Lie from Winesburg, Ohio, by Sherwood Anderson. We are getting to know these characters well, wouldn't you say? There are a total of over 100 characters named in the book, some appearing only once and some recurring several times. Let's crunch some numbers. According to literary scholar Forrest L. Ingram, George Willard recurs in all but 6 stories. 33 characters each appear in more than one story, some of them 5 and 6 times. 91 characters appear only once in the cycle, and 10 of these are central protagonists in their stories. Okay, enough math. Within the stories, characters figure in anecdotes that cover a relatively large time period. Much of the action takes place during George's teenage years, but there are also episodes that go back several generations, like Godliness, or approximately 20 years, like Hands, and anywhere in between. The climactic scenes of 2 stories, The Strength of God and The Teacher, are actually juxtaposed over the course of 1 stormy January evening. As Malcolm Cowley writes in his introduction to the 1960 Viking edition, Anderson's instinct was to present everything together, as in a dream. And now, Queer, concerning Elmer Cowley. From his seat on a box in the rough board shed that stuck like a burr on the rear of Cowley & Son's store in Winesburg, Elmer Cowley, the junior member of the firm, could see through a dirty window into the print shop of the Winesburg Eagle. Elmer was putting new shoelaces in his shoes. They did not go in readily, and he had to take the shoes off. With the shoes in his hand, he sat looking at a large hole in the heel of one of his stockings. Then looking up quickly, he saw George Willard, the only newspaper reporter in Winesburg, standing at the back door of the Eagle print shop and staring absent-mindedly about. "Well, well, what next?" exclaimed the young man, with the shoes in his hand, jumping to his feet and creeping away from the window. A flush crept into Elmer Cowley's face, and his hands began to tremble. In Cowley and Son's store, a Jewish traveling salesman stood by the counter talking to his father. He imagined the reporter could hear what was being said, and the thought made him furious. With one of the shoes still held in his hand, he stood in a corner of the shed and stamped with a stockinged foot upon the board floor. Cowley and Son's store did not face the main street of Winesburg. The front was on Malmy Street, and beyond it was Voigt's wagon shop and a shed for the sheltering of farmers' horses. Beside the store, an alleyway ran behind the main street stores, and all day drays and delivery wagons, intent on bringing in and taking out goods, passed up and down. The store itself was indescribable. Will Henderson once said of it that it sold everything and nothing. In the window facing Malmy Street stood a chunk of coal as large as an apple barrel to indicate that orders for coal were taken, and beside the black mass of the coal stood 3 combs of honey grown brown and dirty in their wooden frames. The honey had stood in the store window for 6 months. It was for sale, as were also the coat hangers, patent suspender buttons, cans of roof paint, bottles of rheumatism cure, and a substitute for coffee that companioned the honey in its patient willingness to serve the public. Ebenezer Cowley, the man who stood in the store listening to the eager patter of words that fell from the lips of the traveling man, was tall and lean and looked unwashed. On his scrawny neck was a large wen, partially covered by a gray beard. He wore a long Prince Albert coat. The coat had been purchased to serve as a wedding garment. Before he became a merchant, Ebenezer was a farmer, and after his marriage he wore the Prince Albert coat to church on Sundays and on Saturday afternoons when he came into town to trade. When he sold the farm to become a merchant, he wore the coat constantly. It had become brown with age and was covered with grease spots. But in it, Ebenezer always felt dressed up and ready for the day in town. As a merchant, Ebenezer was not happily placed in life, and he had not been happily placed as a farmer. Still, he existed. His family, consisting of a daughter named Mabel, and the son, lived with him in rooms above the store, and it did not cost them much to live. His troubles were not financial. His unhappiness as a merchant lay in the fact that when a traveling man with wares to be sold came in at the front door, he was afraid. Behind the counter, he stood shaking his head. He was afraid, first, that he would stubbornly refuse to buy and thus lose the opportunity to sell again. Second, that he would not be stubborn enough and would, in a moment of weakness, buy what could not be sold. In the store on the morning when Elmer Cowley saw George Willard standing and apparently listening at the back door of the Eagle print shop, a situation had arisen that always stirred the son's wrath. The traveling man talked and Ebenezer listened, his whole figure expressing uncertainty. "You see how quickly it is done?" said the traveling man, who had for sale a small, flat metal substitute for collar buttons. With one hand, he quickly unfastened a collar from his shirt and then fastened it on again. He assumed a flattering, wheedling tone. "I tell you what, men have come to the end of all this fooling with collar buttons, and you are the man to make money out of the change that is coming. I am offering you the exclusive agency for this town. Take 20 dozen of these fasteners, and I'll not visit any other store. I'll leave the field to you." The traveling man leaned over the counter and tapped his finger on Ebenezer's breast. "It's an opportunity, and I want you to take it," he urged. "A friend of mine told me about you. See that man Cowley?" he said. "He's a live one." The traveling man paused and waited. Taking a book from his pocket, he began writing out the order. Still holding the shoe in his hand, Elmer Cowley went through the store, past the two absorbed men, to a glass showcase near the front door. He took a cheap revolver from the case and began to wave it about. "You get out of here," he shrieked. "We don't want any collar fasteners here." An idea came to him. "Mind, I'm not making any threat," he added. "I don't say I'll shoot. Maybe I just took the gun out of the case to look at it. But you better get out." "Yes, sir, I'll say that. You better grab up your things and get out." The young storekeeper's voice rose to a scream, and going behind the counter, he began to advance upon the two men. "We're through being fools here," he cried. "We ain't gonna buy any more stuff until we begin to sell. We ain't gonna keep on being queer and have folks staring and listening. You get out of here." The traveling man left, raking the samples of collar fasteners off the counter into a black leather bag. He ran. He was a small man and very bow-legged, and he ran awkwardly. The black bag caught against the door, and he stumbled and fell. "Crazy. That's what he is, crazy," he sputtered as he arose from the sidewalk and hurried away. In the store, Elmer Cowley and his father stared at each other. Now that the immediate object of his wrath had fled, the younger man was embarrassed.
"Well, I meant it. I think we've been queer long enough," he declared, going to the showcase and replacing the revolver.
Sitting on a barrel, he pulled on and fastened the shoes he had been holding in his hand. He was waiting for some word of understanding from his father, but when Ebenezer spoke, his words only served to reawaken the wrath in the son, and the young man ran out of the store without replying. Stretching his gray beard with his long, dirty fingers, the merchant looked at his son with the same wavering, uncertain stare with which he had confronted the traveling salesman.
"I'll be starched," he said softly. "Well, well, I'll be washed and ironed and starched."
Elmer Crowley went out of Winesburg and along a country road that paralleled the railroad track. He did not know where he was going or what he was going to do. In the shelter of a deep cut where the road, after sharply turning to the right, dipped under the tracks, he stopped. And the passion that had been the cause of his outburst in the store began again to find expression.
"I will not be queer, one to be looked at and listened to," he declared aloud. "I'll be like other people. I'll show that George Willard. He'll find out. I'll show him."
The distraught young man stood in the middle of the road and glared back at the town. He did not know the reporter George Willard, and had no special feeling concerning the tall boy who ran about town gathering the town news. The reporter had merely come by his presence in the office and in the print shop of the Winesburg Eagle to stand for something in the young merchant's mind. He thought the boy who passed and repassed Cowley and Son's store, and who stopped to talk to people in the street, must be thinking of him, and perhaps laughing at him. George Willard, he felt, belonged to the town, typified the town, represented in his person the spirit of the town. Elmer Cowley could not have believed that George Willard had also his days of unhappiness, that vague hungers and secret unnameable desires visited also his mind. Did he not represent public opinion, and had not the public opinion of Winesburg condemned the Cowleys to queerness? Did he not walk whistling and laughing through Main Street? Might not one, by striking his person, strike also the greater enemy, the thing that smiled and went on its way, the judgment of Winesburg? Elmer Cowley was extraordinarily tall, and his arms were long and powerful. His hair, his eyebrows, and the downy beard that had begun to grow upon his chin were pale almost to whiteness. His teeth protruded from between his lips, and his eyes were blue with the colorless blueness of the marbles called aggies that the boys of Winesburg carried in their pockets. Elmer had lived in Winesburg for a year and had made no friends. He was, he felt, one condemned to go through life without friends, and he hated the thought. Sullenly, the young man tramped along the road with his hands stuffed into his trouser pockets. The day was cold with a raw wind, but presently the sun began to shine and the road became soft and muddy. The tops of the ridges of frozen mud that formed the road began to melt, and the mud clung to Elmer's shoes. His feet became cold. When he had gone several miles, he turned off the road, crossed a field, and entered a wood. In the wood, he gathered sticks to build a fire, by which he sat trying to warm himself, miserable in body and in mind. For 2 hours he sat on the log by the fire, and then, arising and creeping cautiously through a mass of underbrush, he went to a fence and looked across fields to a small farmhouse surrounded by low sheds. A smile came to his lips, and he began making motions with his long arms to a man who was husking corn in one of the fields. In his hour of misery, the young merchant had returned to the farm where he had lived through boyhood, and where there was another human being to whom he felt he could explain himself. The man on the farm was a half-witted old fellow named Mook. He had once been employed by Ebenezer Cowley and had stayed on the farm when it was sold. The old man lived in one of the unpainted sheds back of the farmhouse and puttered about all day in the fields. Mook the half-wit lived happily. With childlike faith, he believed in the intelligence of the animals that lived in the sheds with him, and when he was lonely, held long conversations with the cows, the pigs, and even the chickens that ran about the barnyard. He it was who had put the expression regarding being laundered into the mouth of his former employer. When excited or surprised by anything, he smiled vaguely and muttered, "I'll be washed and ironed. Well, well, I'll be washed and ironed and starched." When the half-witted old man left his husking of corn and came into the wood to meet Elmer Cowley, he was neither surprised nor especially interested in the sudden appearance of the young man. His feet also were cold, and he sat on the log by the fire, grateful for the warmth and apparently indifferent to what Elmer had to say. Elmer talked earnestly and with great freedom, walking up and down and waving his arms about. "You don't understand what's the matter with me, so of course you don't care," he declared.
With me, it's different. Look at how it has always been with me. Father is queer and mother is queer, too. Even the clothes mother used to wear were not like other people's clothes. And look at that coat in which father goes about here in town, thinking he's dressed up, too. Why don't he get a new one? It wouldn't cost much. I'll tell you why. Father doesn't know. And when mother was alive, she didn't know either. Mabel is different. She knows. But she won't say anything. I will, though. I'm not going to be stared at any longer. Why, look here, Mook. Father doesn't know that his store there in town is just a queer jumble, that he'll never sell the stuff he buys. He knows nothing about it. Sometimes he's a little worried that trade doesn't come, and then he goes and buys something else. In the evenings, he sits by the fire upstairs and says trade will come after a while. He isn't worried. He's queer. He doesn't know enough to be worried.
The excited young man became more excited.
He don't know, but I know,
he shouted, stopping to gaze down into the dumb, unresponsive face of the halfwit.
I know too well. I can't stand it. When we lived out here, it was different. I worked, and at night I went to bed and slept. I wasn't always seeing people and thinking as I am now. In the evening, there in town, I go to the post office or to the depot to see the train come in, and no one says anything to me. Everyone stands around and laughs and they talk, but they say nothing to me. And I feel so queer that I can't talk either. I go away. I don't say anything. I can't.
The fury of the young man became uncontrollable.
I won't stand it,
he yelled, looking up at the bare branches of the trees.
I'm not made to stand it.
Maddened by the dull face of the man on the log by the fire, Elmer turned and glared at him as he had glared back along the road at the town of Winesburg.
Go on back to work, he screamed. What good does it do me to talk to you?
A thought came to him, and his voice dropped.
I'm a coward, too, eh?
He muttered.
Do you know why I came clear out here afoot? I had to tell someone, and you were the only one I could tell. I hunted out another queer one, you see. I ran away, that's what I did. I couldn't stand up to someone like George Willard. I had to come to you. To tell him. And I will.
Again his voice arose to a shout, and his arms flew about.
I will tell him. I won't be queer. I don't care what they think. I won't stand it.
Elmer Cowley ran out of the woods, leaving the halfwit sitting on the log before the fire. Presently, the old man arose, and climbing over the fence, went back to his work in the corn.
I'll be washed and ironed and starched, he declared. Well, well, I'll be washed and ironed.
Mook was interested. He went along a lane to a field where two cows stood nibbling at a straw stack.
Elmer was here, he said to the cows. Elmer's crazy. You better get behind the stack where he don't see you. He'll hurt someone yet, Elmer will.
At 8 o'clock that evening, Elmer Cowley put his head in at the front door of the office of the Winesburg Eagle, where George Willard sat writing. His cap was pulled down over his eyes, and a sullen, determined look was on his face.
You come outside with me,
he said, stepping in and closing the door. He kept his hand on the knob, as though prepared to resist anyone else coming in.
You just come along outside. I want to see you.
George Willard and Elmer Cowley walked through the main street of Winesburg. The night was cold, and George Willard had on a new overcoat and looked very spruce and dressed up. He thrust his hands into the overcoat pockets and looked inquiringly at his companion. He had long been waiting to make friends with the young merchant and find out what was in his mind. Now he thought he saw a chance and was delighted.
I wonder what he's up to. Perhaps he thinks he has a piece of news for the paper. It can't be a fire because I haven't heard the fire bell, and there isn't anyone running, he thought.
In the main street of Winesburg, on the cold November evening, but few citizens appeared, and these hurried along, bent on getting to the stove at the back of some store. The windows on the stores were frosted, and the wind rattled the tin sign that hung over the entrance to the stairway leading to Dr. Welling's office. Before Hearn's grocery, a basket of apples and a rack filled with new brooms stood on the sidewalk. Elmer Cowley stopped and stood facing George Willard. He tried to talk, and his arms began to pump up and down. His face worked spasmodically. He seemed about to shout.
"Oh, you go on back," he cried. "Don't stay out here with me. I ain't got anything to tell you. I don't want to see you at all."
For 3 hours, the distracted young merchant wandered through the resident streets of Winesburg, blind with anger, brought on by his failure to declare his determination not to be queer. Bitterly, the sense of defeat settled upon him, and he wanted to weep. After the hours of futile sputtering at nothingness that had occupied the afternoon, and his failure in the presence of the young reporter, he thought he could see no hope of a future for himself. And then a new idea dawned for him. In the darkness that surrounded him, he began to see a light. Going to the now darkened store, where Cowley and son had for over a year waited vainly for trade to come, he crept stealthily in and felt about in a barrel that stood by the stove at the rear. In the barrel, beneath shavings, lay a tin box containing Cowley and son's cash. Every evening, Ebenezer Cowley put the box in the barrel when he closed the store and went upstairs to bed.
"They wouldn't ever think of a careless place like that," he told himself,
thinking of robbers. Elmer took $20, two $10 bills, from the little roll containing perhaps $400, the cash left from the sale of the farm. Then replacing the box beneath the shavings, he went quietly out at the front door and walked again in the streets. The idea he thought might put an end to all of his unhappiness was very simple.
"I will get out of here, run away from home," he told himself.
He knew that a local freight train passed through Winesburg at midnight and went on to Cleveland, where it arrived at dawn. He would steal a ride on the local, and when he got to Cleveland, would lose himself in the crowds there. He would get work in some shop and become friends with the other workmen and would be indistinguishable. Then he could talk and laugh. He would no longer be queer and would make friends. Life would begin to have warmth and meaning for him, as it had for others. The tall, awkward young man, striding through the streets, laughed at himself because he had been angry and had been half afraid of George Willard. He decided he would have his talk with the young reporter before he left town, that he would tell him about things, perhaps challenge him, challenge all of Winesburg through him. Aglow with new confidence, Elmer went to the office of the new Willard house and pounded on the door. A sleepy-eyed boy slept on a cot in the office. He received no salary but was fed at the hotel table and bore with pride the title of night clerk. Before the boy, Elmer was bold, insistent.
"You wake him up," he commanded. "You tell him to come down by the depot. I gotta see him, and I'm going away on the local. Tell him to dress and come on down. I ain't got much time."
The midnight local had finished its work in Winesburg, and the trainsmen were coupling cars, swinging lanterns, and preparing to resume their flight east. George Willard, rubbing his eyes and again wearing the new overcoat, ran down to the station platform afire with curiosity.
"Well, here I am. What do you want? You got something to tell me, eh?" he said.
Elmer tried to explain. He wet his lips with his tongue and looked at the train that had begun to groan and get underway.
"Well, you see," he began,
and then lost control of his tongue.
"I'll be washed and ironed. I'll be washed and ironed and starched,"
he muttered half incoherently. Elmer Cowley danced with fury beside the groaning train in the darkness on the station platform. Lights leaped into the air and bobbed up and down before his eyes. Taking the two $10 bills from his pocket, he thrust them into George Willard's hand.
"Take them," he cried. "I don't want them. Give them to Father. I stole them."
With a snarl of rage, he turned, and his long arms began to flay the air. Like one struggling for release from hands that held him, he struck out, hitting George Willard blow after blow on the breast, the neck, the mouth. The young reporter rolled over on the platform half unconscious, stunned by the terrific force of the blows. Springing aboard the passenger train and running over the tops of the cars, Elmer sprang down to a flat car and, lying on his face, looked back, trying to see the fallen man in the darkness. Pride surged up in him.
"I showed him," he cried. "I guess I showed him. I ain't so queer. I guess I showed him I ain't so queer."
The Untold Lie Concerning Ray Pearson. Ray Pearson and Hal Winters were farmhands employed on a farm 3 miles north of Winesburg. On Saturday afternoons, they came into town and wandered about through the streets with other fellows from the country. Ray was a quiet, rather nervous man of perhaps 50, with a brown beard and shoulders rounded by too much and too hard labor. In his nature, he was as unlike Hal Winters as two men can be unlike. Ray was an altogether serious man and had a little sharp-featured wife who had also a sharp voice. The two, with a half-dozen thin-legged children, lived in a tumble-down frame house beside a creek at the back end of the Wills farm where Ray was employed. Hal Winters, his fellow employee, was a young fellow. He was not of the Ned Winters family, who were very respectable people in Winesburg, but was one of the three sons of the old man called Wind Peter Winters, who had a sawmill near Unionville, 6 miles away, and who was looked upon by everyone in Winesburg as a confirmed old retrobate. People from the part of northern Ohio in which Winesburg lies will remember old Wind Peter by his unusual and tragic death. He got drunk one evening in town and started to drive home to Unionville along the railroad tracks. Henry Brattenberg, the butcher, who lived out that way, stopped him at the edge of the town and told him he was sure to meet the down train, but Wind Peter slashed at him with his whip and drove on. When the train struck and killed him and his two horses, a farmer and his wife who were driving home along a nearby road saw the accident. They said that old Wind Peter stood up on the seat of his wagon, raving and swearing at the onrushing locomotive, and that he fairly screamed with delight when the team, maddened by his incessant slashing at them, rushed straight ahead to certain death. Boys like young George Willard and Seth Richmond will remember the incident quite vividly, because although everyone in our town said that the old man would go straight to hell and that the community was better off without him, they had a secret conviction that he knew what he was doing and admired his foolish courage. Most boys have seasons of wishing they could die gloriously instead of just being grocery clerks and going on with their humdrum lives. But this is not the story of Wind Peter Winters, nor yet of his son Hal, who worked on the Wills farm with Ray Pearson. It is Ray's story. It will, however, be necessary to talk a little of young Hal so that you will get into the spirit of it. Hal was a bad one. Everyone said that. There were three of the Winters boys in that family, John, Hal, and Edward, all broad-shouldered big fellows, like old Wind Peter himself, and all fighters and woman chasers, and generally all around bad ones. Hal was the worst of the lot, and always up to some devilment. He once stole a load of boards from his father's mill and sold them in Winesburg. With the money, he bought himself a suit of cheap, flashy clothes. Then he got drunk, and when his father came raving into town to find him, they met and fought with their fists on Main Street and were arrested and put into jail together. Hal went to work on the Wills farm because there was a country school teacher out that way who had taken his fancy. He was only 22 then, but had already been in 2 or 3 of what were spoken of in Winesburg as women scrapes. Everyone who heard of his infatuation for the schoolteacher was sure it would only turn out badly.
He'll get her into trouble, you'll see,
was the word that went around. And so, these two men, Ray and Hal, were at work in a field on a day in the late October. They were husking corn, and occasionally something was said, and they laughed. Then came silence. Ray, who was the more sensitive and always minded things more, had chapped hands and they hurt. He put them into his coat pocket and looked away across the fields. He was in a sad, distracted mood and was affected by the beauty of the country. If you knew the Winesburg country in the fall and how the low hills are all splashed with yellow and reds, you would understand his feeling. He began to think of the time, long ago when he was a young fellow living with his father, then a baker in Winesburg, and how on such days he had wandered away into the woods to gather nuts, hunt rabbits, or just to loaf about and smoke his pipe. His marriage had come about through one of his days of wandering. He had induced a girl who waited on trade in his father's shop to go with him, and something had happened. He was thinking of that afternoon, and how it had affected his whole life, when a spirit of protest awoke in him. He had forgotten about Hal and muttered words.
Tricked, by gad. That's what it was. Tricked by life and made a fool of,
he said in a low voice. As though understanding his thoughts, Hal Winters spoke up.
Well, has it been worthwhile? What about it, eh? What about marriage and all that?
He asked, and then laughed. Hal tried to keep on laughing, but he too was in an earnest mood. He began to talk earnestly.
Has a fella gotta do it? He asked. Has he gotta be harnessed up and driven through life like a horse?
He didn't wait for an answer, but sprang to his feet and began to walk back and forth between the corn shocks. He was getting more and more excited. Bending down suddenly, he picked up an ear of yellow corn and threw it at the fence.
I've got Nell Gunther in trouble, he said. I'm telling you, but you keep your mouth shut.
Ray Pearson arose and stood staring. He was almost a foot shorter than Hal, and when the younger man came and put his two hands on the older man's shoulders, they made a picture. There they stood in the big, empty field with the quiet corn shocks standing in rows behind them, and the red and yellow hills in the distance, and from being just two indifferent workmen, they had become all alive to each other. Hal sensed it, and because that was his way, he laughed.
Well, old daddy, he said awkwardly, come on, advise me. I've got Nell in trouble. Perhaps you've been in the same fix yourself. I know what everyone would say is the right thing to do, but what do you say? Shall I marry and settle down? Shall I put myself into the harness to be worn out like an old horse? You know me, Ray. There can't anyone break me, but I can break myself. Shall I do it? Or shall I tell Nell to go to the devil? Come on, you tell me. Whatever you say, Ray, I'll do.
Ray couldn't answer. He shook Al's hands loose and, turning, walked straight away to the barn. He was a sensitive man, and there were tears in his eyes. He knew there was only one thing to say to Hal Winters, son of old Windpeter Winters, only one thing that all his own training and all the beliefs of the people he knew would approve. But for his life, he couldn't say what he knew he should say. At 4:30 that afternoon, Ray was puttering about the barnyard when his wife came up the lane along the creek and called him. After the talk with Hal, he hadn't returned to the cornfield, but worked about the barn. He had already done the evening chores and had seen Hal, dressed and ready for a roistering night in town, come out of the farmhouse and go into the road. Along the path to his own house, he trudged behind his wife, looking at the ground and thinking. He couldn't make out what was wrong. Every time he raised his eyes and saw the beauty of the country in the falling light, he wanted to do something he had never done before, shout or scream or hit his wife with his fists or something equally unexpected and terrifying. Along the path he went, scratching his head and trying to make it out. He looked hard at his wife's back, but she seemed all right. She only wanted him to go into town for groceries, and as soon as she had told him what she wanted, began to scold.
"You're always puttering," she said. "Now I want you to hustle. There isn't anything in the house for supper, and you've got to get to town and back in a hurry."
Ray went into his own house and took an overcoat from a hook back of the door. It was torn about the pockets and the collar was shiny. His wife went into the bedroom and presently came out with a soiled cloth in one hand and 3 silver dollars in the other. Somewhere in the house, a child wept bitterly, and a dog that had been sleeping by the stove arose and yawned. Again, the wife scolded.
"The children will cry and cry. Why are you always puttering?" she asked.
Ray went out of the house and climbed the fence into a field. It was just growing dark, and the scene that lay before him was lovely. All the low hills were washed with color, and even the little clusters of bushes in the corners of the fences were alive with beauty. The whole world seemed to Ray Pearson to have become alive with something, just as he and Hal had suddenly become alive when they stood in the cornfield, staring into each other's eyes. The beauty of the country about Winesburg was too much for Ray on that fall evening. That is all there was to it. He could not stand it. Of a sudden, he forgot all about being a quiet old farmhand, and throwing off the torn overcoat, began to run across the field. As he ran, he shouted a protest against his life, against all life, against everything that makes life ugly.
"There was no promise made," he cried into the
empty spaces that lay about him.
"I didn't promise my Minnie anything, and Hal hasn't made any promise to Nell. I know he hasn't. She went into that woods with him because she wanted to go. What he wanted, she wanted. Why should I pay? Why should Hal pay? Why should anyone pay? I don't want Hal to become old and worn out. I'll tell him. I won't let it go on. I'll catch Hal before he gets to town and tell him."
Ray ran clumsily, and once he stumbled and fell down.
"I must catch Hal and tell him," he kept thinking.
And although his breath came in gasps, he kept running harder and harder. As he ran, he thought of things that hadn't come into his mind for years. How at the time he married, he had planned to go west to his uncle in Portland, Oregon. How he hadn't wanted to be a farmhand, but had thought when he got out west, he would go to sea and be a sailor, or get a job on a ranch and ride a horse into western towns, shouting and laughing and waking the people in the houses with his wild cries. Then, as he ran, he remembered his children, and in fancy felt their hands clutching at him. All of his thoughts of himself were involved with the thoughts of Hal, and he thought the children were clutching at the younger man also.
"They are the accidents of life, Hal," he cried. "They're not mine or yours. I had nothing to do with them."
Darkness began to spread over the fields as Ray Pearson ran on and on. His breath came in little sobs. When he came to the fence at the edge of the road and confronted Hal Winters, all dressed up and smoking a pipe as he walked jauntily along, he could not have told what he thought or what he wanted. Ray Pearson lost his nerve, and this is really the end of the story of what happened to him. It was almost dark when he got to the fence, and he put his hands on the top bar and stood staring. Hal Winters jumped a ditch and came up close to Ray, put his hands into his pockets, and laughed. He seemed to have lost his own sense of what had happened in the cornfield, and when he put up a strong hand and took hold of the lapel of Ray's coat, he shook the man as he might have shaken a dog that had misbehaved.
"You come to tell me, eh?" he said. "Well, never mind telling me anything. I'm not a coward, and I've already made up my mind."
He laughed again and jumped back across the ditch.
"Nell ain't no fool," he said. "She didn't ask me to marry her. I want to marry her. I want to settle down and have kids."
Ray Pearson also laughed. He felt like laughing at himself and all the world. As the form of Hal Winters disappeared in the dusk that lay over the road that led to Winesburg, He turned and walked slowly back across the field to where he had left his torn overcoat. As he went, some memory of pleasant evenings spent with the thin-legged children in the tumble-down house by the creek must have come into his mind, for he muttered words.
"It's just as well. Whatever I told him would have been a lie,"
he said softly, and then his form also disappeared into the darkness of the fields. And those are our stories for this evening. I hope you enjoyed Queer and The Untold Lie from Winesburg, Ohio, by Sherwood Anderson. Thank you for listening. I'm Jennifer March, and this is not your mother's story time.